This episode of She Explores is brought to you by Oru Kayak. They design folding kayaks that can go virtually anywhere thanks to their lightweight and folding design. Stay tuned for later in the episode. We talk to Whitney Neighbor about living in Seattle and enjoying water both near and far. I'm Gail Straub, and you're listening to She Explores.
Why I feel so strongly about it is, I mean, it literally is my backyard, and I use it as my backyard. So I feel like I am a steward of the land. So I want to protect it.
This is Bridget Meinhold, a landscape painter. And the backyard that she mentions is Bonanza Flats, 1,350 acres of what is currently privately held land near Park City, Utah. With 22 national monuments currently under review by the Secretary of the Interior, there's been a lot of talk about what we can do to protect land in the United States. Several episodes ago, we talked with Katie Bouet about how you can be an advocate online for public land and also by calling your representatives. But this is about land on a local level. Of those 22 national monuments, Bears Ears Monument in Utah has become the complicated poster child for that conversation. And it is complicated. Over 1.3 million acres and important Native American artifacts make it a very different conversation from the one that Bridget and I had. But as a recent New York Times article on Bears Ears by Terry Tempest Williams stated, one park or monument at risk means all are at risk. In its simplest form, Bridget is using her skill as a landscape painter to try to save a landscape that she loves, its wildlife, and its clean water. And it's literally her backyard. Bridget and the residents of Park City, Utah are fighting to protect a piece of land that is 1,000 times smaller than Bears Ears. Yet it's important because open land in the form of conservation easements that are maintained by land trusts help protect our environment and local agriculture. And these easements make up no small area of public land. Across the U.S., 56 million acres have been conserved. 72% of that land allows for public access, so we can recreate and enjoy it without endangering it. Much of it is managed on a state and local level, which brings us to this conversation today. But I'm getting a little ahead of myself here. To get to the heart of why Bridget was fighting for Bonanza Flats, we have to get to know her and her work.
My husband and I, we live in about a 600 square foot A-frame cabin, and it's got one room downstairs with the kitchen and a bathroom, and then upstairs bedroom is a loft. And next door is my studio. We built that in 2009, and it's a 40 foot shipping container that we transformed into studio space. We put it on our property and put a shed roof on top and some windows and an extra man door and split it in half. And my husband has one side of it that he uses to build all my frames in. It's his wood workshop. And the other half is my art studio.
Oh, it's really awesome. So living in a smaller than typical house and having probably a smaller than typical studio, you have a lot of access to the landscape.
Yeah, we have about 3/4 of an acre surrounded by an aspen grove and views of the mountains. And so we live in a small house, but it feels large to us at least.
So what brought you to that area? What motivated you and your husband to choose to live there?
My husband has been in Park City since 92. So he's been here for a long time, and he's owned the cabin since 98. And I moved to Park City in 2004 after college and after living in Europe for a year, and I was waiting to find out about grad school, and I wanted to be a ski bum for a winter. And so I moved to Park City because I had a friend who lived here, and she had an extra room and said, oh, well, come live with me. At least you'll know one person. So I got there right around Thanksgiving of 2004, and then I started applying for jobs. I was going to, you know, wait tables and then ski as much as possible. And the restaurant that I ended up getting a job at, which was Zoom, and as I walked in to apply for the job, the first person I met is now my husband. I met him pretty much right away when I moved to town.
Would you say it was partially your husband, partially the area that kept you there for now 13 years?
Absolutely. I came for the winter and stayed for the summer and wasn't planning on staying for the summer, but it was just so beautiful that I couldn't leave. But then I did go to grad school for about a year and a half and came back and forth a lot. And then so I've been in Park City full time officially since 2007.
And what did you study in grad school?
I actually got my master's in civil and environmental engineering from Stanford.
Oh. And do you do artwork full time now?
I'm a full time artist. For a number of years after I finished grad school, I was working as a sustainability consultant. So I was helping businesses do carbon footprinting and reduce their carbon footprint and find ways to be more sustainable and energy efficient. Then unfortunately, when the economy tanked, there was no funding for consultants. So that's when I started writing. So I wrote for many years for a website called Inhabitat and some other online websites about sustainability and green design. And I wrote a book on architecture in the context of natural disasters, which came out in 2013, I think. All the while I was working on art on the side, just slowly started getting my work into galleries. First here in Park City at a gallery called Gallery Mar. I also show in Durango at Diane West Art, Vickers Collection in Aspen, and the Bolam Gallery in Truckee, California. So I went full-time art in 2015. This is my, second, third year now as full-time artist.
I know Bridget's not going to say this, but it's hard work making a living as a painter. Not only are you dependent on being creatively inspired, you're essentially the CEO of your own little company. And not just the CEO. You have to be head of sales and marketing. You have to do your books. You have to create an online presence. You have to do PR. There's just a lot more to it than picking up a paintbrush and feeling inspired. It's a profession that is equally romanticized and scoffed at. It is hard, incredibly fulfilling work.
The switch over was a little daunting because I was still writing in the background and not making as much money writing, slowly making more money painting, and so it seemed worth it. And it was a great switch. I'm so happy I did it. But of course, you know, like any freelance work, there's ups and downs, and there's times when sales are great and times when sales aren't as good, times when you have commissions, times when you don't. So it's just like anything.
So what does a typical day look like for you, if there's a typical day?
I don't really have much of a typical day. We travel a fair amount. So my husband is a captain with the Park City Fire Department. So he works 2 days straight at the station, and then he's off for 4 days. So it makes it so that we can travel a lot. But if I was home and I'm working, that means waking up, doing my stretches, having breakfast, and then getting out to the studio for a few hours, taking a break, going and skiing in the winter, or going for a bike ride in the summer, and then usually back for a few more hours in the afternoon or early evening. It kind of really just depends on what the weather is doing. If the weather's great, that means we're out playing, biking and climbing, or if it's crappy weather, then we're inside and working. It's really weather dependent more than anything.
Would you say you draw a lot of your inspiration from those outdoor activities and the landscape surrounding you?
Absolutely. Without my time spent outdoors, I wouldn't have any art, really. Because of where we live, we're pretty high elevation. We're at 8,600 feet. I feel like I live in the weather rather than just look at it. If you lived in downtown in Park City, obviously you get the weather too, but oftentimes you look up at the mountains and see what the weather is doing up in the mountains. Well, I live in the mountains, even more so than town, and so I feel like I'm part of the weather most of the time. For my main studio work that gets put into the galleries, those paintings are very atmospheric, very kind of weathery, foggy, ethereal looking. So being outside in the elements, in the weather, really informs my artwork.
And what medium do you typically use for your paintings?
I am an encaustic painter, which means I paint with hot wax. It's a beeswax mixed with a little bit of Damar resin. I paint with hot wax. It's about 200 degrees. I use big 6-inch brushes to paint the hot liquid wax onto a hardwood surface, and as that cools, it hardens. And then I use scraping tools and a torch to smooth that wax. And then I start building layers up of the wax and another paint called milk paint, which I use to paint trees and mountains with. And I keep layering those. So I'll do a layer of wax, and then I'll do a layer of milk paint. And then basically I'm forming a three-dimensional landscape in a 2D space.
And why landscape painting?
I'm fascinated by looking out over a landscape. The medium of encaustic really lends itself to that. So the wax actually acts the part of the atmosphere for me. And you know when you're looking at mountains far off in a distance and that they're blue, even though you know they're green because of all the pine trees or the aspens or whatever, but they look blue in the distance. Well, that's because there's atmosphere in between you and that mountain. And that's what shifts that color for your eyes. And so for me, in my paintings, the wax does that.
I love hearing you describe it. And I like hearing about the connection between where you live and the artwork that you create, which is really why we're talking today, too. Could you describe the area of Bonanza Flats for me?
So Bonanza Flats is this parcel of land situated literally in the heart of the Wasatch Mountains between Salt Lake Valley and Park City. And it sits at the junction of three counties, Salt Lake County, Summit County, and Wasatch County. And it's about 1,350 acres. And some of it's kind of in the valley, the basin of this valley. And then it's surrounded by a few peaks to the west. And it's filled with mostly the most beautiful aspen groves you've seen. I mean, of course, I'm completely partial and biased that we have the best aspens in all of Utah, but we really do. Yesterday, I was out for a hike and I saw two twin moose. I'm pretty certain they were twins because they were about the same size, and one was male and one was female. I saw a whole bunch of deer this morning. We have a lot of red-tailed hawks, which are fun to watch. Owls, coyotes. Every once in a while, we'll have a bear. And a cougar will come through, but cougar's pretty rare. Fox, love seeing the fox. Badgers, and a lot of squirrels and chipmunks and what we call potguts here in Utah. That's what's so unique about this spot. It is unspoiled, but it's so close to cities that it's so special because of that. We have such incredible access to this gem. God, it would be just a shame to see it turned into a luxury ski resort and full of giant McMansions, losing half the trees, and it would just break my heart.
After the break, I talk with Bridget about what's at stake and how she's doing everything she can to make sure that doesn't happen. The folks at Oru Kayak believe that connecting to nature is a deep human need, even for those of us, like Whitney Neighbor, who live in cities. I talked with Whitney about where she and her friends take their Orus around Seattle.
Once you do get the hang of it, you have a kayak in like 10 minutes. You park, set up your kayak, and you're in the water in 10 minutes. And that's really nice, especially for wanting to be out on the water for a couple hours in the evening, during the week. It's fun because there are a lot of smaller bodies of water in Seattle. I live really close to a lake called Green Lake, and it's like a really small lake that people go to walk around or just hang out at. And so that's a really close thing if I ever want to, or some friends and I ever want to just go kayak for an evening, taking them down there and having a picnic out on the water. It's quick and easy. You can do it for an hour. But we do also like to take them on either day trips, or like if we're camping, we'll take them out to the coast. We took them to Deception Pass and paddled around in one of the bays and watched sunset there and paddled with the seals. They definitely keep their distance, but it's fun to watch them like pop up their heads, and then they'll kind of stare at you for a little bit, and then they'll disappear, and then they'll pop up from a different angle and keep staring at you. It's fun.
Explore near and far in a beautiful, foldable Oru kayak. Learn more at www.orukayak.com. That's www.orukayak.com.
God, it would be just a shame to see it turned into a luxury ski resort and full of giant McMansions, losing half the trees, and it would just break my heart.
And that's what's at risk.
Exactly. So the property is up for sale. The initial company that was looking at buying it is called Discovery Lands. They developed the Yellowstone Club and a whole bunch of other luxury resorts that are private, completely off limits to anybody that doesn't have bukus of money. So they know how to develop, you know, resorts. They're not new to this game. So they could definitely transform it. And the great thing that happened was that the company who currently owns it wanted to make a deal a little bit quicker than Discovery Lands could manage. So they went to Park City, the city of Park City, and said, if you can close on this deal by June 15th, then it's yours. And they negotiated at a price of $38 million. Well, the great thing was that the city of Park City last fall had the foresight to bond for open space. And they bonded for $25 million, and the voters overwhelmingly supported it and said yes. It was like 75% of the voters said yes, that we want to bond for this, and we'll pay for it. So Park City had $25 million ready to go when this deal happened. And so then we had to come up with a $13 million shortfall. And so starting in mid-January, a number of nonprofits around the area, like Utah Open Lands, Summit Land Conservancy, Wasatch Back Country Alliance, Friends of Alta, and a number of other organizations banded together and said, this is really important. We're going to spend, you know, the next few months campaigning as hard as we can to try and raise that $13 million. And now we are, you know, about 2 weeks away from that deadline, and we're still $2.6 million short. So we still have a pretty big gap to go. Although, you know, looking at the other side and seeing that we've raised over $10 million in such a short time, largely through a lot of grassroots campaigning and just asking individuals for money, it's really impressive the turnout that we've had so far. And yet we still need more help to finish and be able to purchase this place and protect it forever. And so that's what I've been largely focused on since January. I've spent a lot of time on this, as well as a number of other people have in the area, neighbors and friends and other people who really care about this place, have been working really hard to raise money.
So have you talked to anyone who is in favor of the development and gotten a feel for like what their reasoning is for that?
Well, money. It's just all about money. I mean,
money kind of feels like the answer to every question. The story of Bonanza Flats is no exception. A developer wants to acquire the land to profit off of an expansive ski and golf high-income community to make money. The current landowner is willing to sell the 1,300 acres to Park City at a price of $38 million, $13 million above what the citizens voted on to reserve for. And on the other side, Park City will likely benefit monetarily by Bonanza Flats not being developed. Tourists who come to the area can bike and backcountry ski and hike. They come for the land and they stay and spend money through food and lodging. Also, there's likely a tax benefit to the city reserving the land as a conservation easement. So as much as it's a bummer, money is really an unavoidable aspect of the open land conversation. It's something that we have to understand, especially when we're thinking on a local level.
What the development company has planned is about 260 home lots. There's a golf course in the works and a couple private ski runs as well. It's all just largely money driven.
To me, it's like a little ironic. I am not as familiar with mountain towns coming from the East Coast, but what I've seen of areas that do get built up like that, you lose what's special about the area, and people are paying to have access to what's special about it. You would think, besides just luxury restaurants and ski mountains. So there's got to be a tipping point too, where the town needs to step in and help save open land, like Park City is trying to do with this area.
Park City on a whole, and for the last number of years, has been very good about saving open space. The area is continually trying to purchase land and save it. But I don't think that's typical for everywhere. Wasatch County, which is technically where we live, Wasatch County just came to the realization that this is something that they maybe should be doing. After going to a number of council meetings, they're like, should we be bonding for open space? Do people want open space? Like, it just occurred to them that that's something to do. But not everybody does that. There's been a lot of foresight in the Park City area to have open space, which is why it's such a special place to come to and visit. And that's why we're known for our mountain biking, because we have hundreds of miles of interconnected trails that go through open space.
So what have you done personally so far to help raise money to save Bonanza Flats?
I've done a number of projects over the last few months to help save Bonanza Flats. The first one I did, I worked with Utah Open Lands to hold an art auction. And I created a painting based on the valley that featured a couple of the main mountain peaks. And I painted this landscape and we put it up for auction. We had this great event at Gallery Mar. It was well attended and we got a couple of people who really were serious about buying it. They went into a bidding war and finally the auction closed and it sold for $10,500, which was amazing. I was absolutely beyond thrilled at that price. I would have never thought it would have gone for that much. But the even better part about it was that the quote-unquote loser of the auction was there and came up to me and said, look, I didn't win the auction, but I still want a painting. Would you be willing to paint another one for me and I'll pay the same price? So I then painted a second painting and raised another $10,500. And then I also sold the watercolor study that I had done for that painting for another $1,000. So in one night, I was able to raise $22,000.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
$22,000. I want to wrap my head around that. Give it some scale. $22,000 isn't much to a millionaire who vacations in Park City. Of the $38 million that Bonanza Flats is currently worth, $22,000 of that is just about 0.06%. Bridget would have to paint and sell 3,600 paintings to raise $38 million. That's an incredible amount of time and energy and materials. And I'm not saying that to downplay Bridget's donation. If you take the inverse approach, the average amount a visual artist makes in a year is $53,400, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics and based on the last census. Anecdotally, $53,000 a year, that balance feels a little generous. But if it is true, that $22,000 represents 41% of a painter's annual income. So I guess I do the math on that to say that I admire the dedication that Bridget has to saving a landscape so close to her. I don't know personally if I would be able to make that kind of sacrifice, but hearing stories of people like Bridget makes me know that it's possible. And auctioning those paintings and raising $22,000, it's not all that Bridget's doing.
The 100 Imagine Landscape Project is part of the 100 Day Project, which was started originally, I believe, by a Princeton art professor who encouraged his students to spend 100 days doing one activity as a way to further learn about it and, you know, either get good at it or just become experienced at one thing. And I found out about it through another artist via Instagram. Her name is Elle Luna, and she wrote this great art book called At the Crossroads of Should and Must. She's not running the 100 Day Project, but she's kind of running a small subset of it and encouraging people, you know, kind of being a voice to keep people motivated and going. And so I chose to do it this year. This is my first time doing the 100 Day Project. At first, I was just going to do it and because I wanted to improve my skills with watercolor. Watercolor is what I do when I travel and when I'm out doing plein air painting. And that's what I do in my sketchbook. So I just wanted to improve skills. And as we were getting closer to the start date, I realized, what am I going to do with all these when I'm done? They're just going to sit there. So I realized, well, I might as well sell them. and try and raise money for Bonanza Flat. Started an Etsy shop, and so far, out of the 58 that I've done, I think I've sold over 40.
Is it challenging at all to create even a small painting every day?
Yeah. Making sure that you have to do a painting every day is a little trying sometimes. Some days it's really exciting, especially if I know what I want to paint. And then there's other days where either I'm tired or we're traveling or I've already been in the studio for 6 hours. I'm just like, oh, what the heck am I going to paint? Those are hard days. But overall, frankly, I am rarely at a loss for inspiration. I think there's only been one day where I was like, I don't know what to paint. They all are inspired by a real place, something I saw the day before, but they're not true to life. I'm not trying to recreate what I saw. I'm just trying to mimic what I felt at that spot, mimic what the idea of that place was. That has been actually really freeing for me, because beforehand in all my other watercolors, I was really trying to create a replica of a picture or a place, and I was getting frustrated because my skills aren't what I want them to be. Having this imagined aspect of it is allowing me to say, oh, well, that mountain doesn't look anything like that in the picture, but that's okay. It's just another mountain. And so it's letting me practice skills without worrying about the final outcome.
And the, you know, that feeling that you had, that can resonate with other people too, even if it's not the exact place. Do you have any favorite places to do plein air painting?
I just like being outside. It really doesn't matter. I mean, right now I'm really fascinated by the snow-capped mountains, you know, the blue and the snow melting off of them. That's really fun to paint right now. But, you know, I was just down in the desert last week and painting sagebrush, just kind of whatever's in front of my face is kind of my favorite thing, it seems like.
Oh, that's great. And Bonanza Flats is right in front of your face a lot.
When I'm home, when we're in Park City, I am walking and hiking on it pretty much every day. In the winter, I'm cross-country skiing or backcountry skiing. And in the summer, we're biking or hiking. I'm there every day. That was one of the things why I feel so strongly about it is, I mean, it literally is my backyard. And I use it as my backyard. So I feel like I am a steward of the land. So I want to protect it.
How did you get involved initially? How did you hear about it? And then how did you decide this is what I want to do to help this cause?
Living up here, we had been keeping close track of what was going on with the property, knowing that it was up for sale and that it could be potentially bought by a developer. So we'd been tracking it. And then when we heard that the deal had gone through with Park City, I started contacting all the organizations that were getting involved in the city and said, how can I help? How can I help? What can I do? So then I just came up with, well, I'll sell a painting. Who knows? I don't know how much I'll raise from it, but, you know, anything helps. So I just started sending out information about it. I have my own email list that I send out to people, a couple hundred people with updates. And I've gone to a lot of council meetings. I think a lot of us in this last year have become a lot more civically involved than we were previously. So it's been a very interesting experience, not only civically involved, you know, on the national level, but civically involved on the local level, which is really important to be engaged in that way. I think the local level civics affect you actually far more than what happens nationally.
And in certain ways, like you said, when you were pitching this to me, it's easier to enact change on a local level. With this project, you don't have to go and have it voted through the state of Utah. Like it can happen through the work of nonprofits and individuals at a city level.
That's what's so interesting about this process. And we're not tied down by bureaucracy. We're not tied down by getting a vote for yes or having presidential approval or getting it revoked. All we need is just people to donate money.
Again, that money thing, it's real. And while there's no denying that Park City is a more affluent mountain town that benefits from tourism, donations help show Park City and the surrounding counties that the citizens care about preserving open land, that they're willing to donate $5, $10, $10,000, $22,000 in the form of a painting. Shows that they care. And those amounts, they can make a difference. Bridget shared with me how we can get involved.
For those who are interested in supporting, even $5 would be great. You can go to savebonanzaflats.org, and there's a direct donate button there. And then come visit, obviously. But otherwise, for people who are local or Salt Lake County residents, please contact your representatives and ask them to contribute. And then the other thing that I've been so lovely surprised about is how people are coming together and coming up with really creative ways to raise money. This one friend, Andrew Muse, he travels around and does a whole bunch of adventure stuff. And he did this amazing fundraiser where he gathered up all of his sponsors and had them donate gear. And he raised $30,000 in one night at this really fun party on Main Street. I've had a neighbor of mine who's a baker. She did these amazing baked goods. My nephew at his middle school, through his honor society, they did bake sales over like course of a couple weeks. And I think they raised like $3,000. So I think just any way you can use your skills to come up with funding or to just raise awareness, you know, even a social media post, it does matter. It does help, because the more it gets in front of people's eyes, the more likely they're able to do something. If everybody is posting about one cause, then people have to take notice.
And also, even if the person lives across the country, it might motivate them to look into what's going on in their own backyard.
Exactly. I've learned a lot of things throughout this whole project. But one of the things I learned was that county governments and city governments, they're busy. They don't know that they need to be doing things like making open space unless their residents come to them and say, this is something that we want, and this is where we want our funding to go towards. And so it's just getting involved.
You can learn more about land trusts, Bonanza Flats, and Bridget Meinhold at the podcast episode page via she-explores.com. Bridget is also selling t-shirts through Prival USA with a special Bonanza Flats design through June 15th. All profits go to the effort. You can find a link on the landing page as well. Thank you to Bridget for talking with us and sharing all of her hard work. Thanks to our sponsor, Aura Kayak. If you enjoy the episode, subscribe via Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Even better, tell a friend about it. Music is by Lee Rosevere. Next week, we'll have our special To Dad from Daughter Father's Day episode. Thank you to everyone who submitted voice memos. I'll be in touch with you if it's a fit for the episode about next steps. Until next week, bye.